Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Patrick, these are hard times.
Nope, Jim, these are great times because we have Ryan Miller from Guster on our show.
Patrick, we went backstage the other day.
Yeah, that was fun, wasn't it? At the 9:30 Club.
The 9:30 Club. Mm-hmm. It's so funny that of all the interviews we've done for the show, that was our first one actually at the 9:30 Club, right?
Yeah, I believe that was the first time we were there together interviewing somebody backstage for this podcast. Yes. So that was cool.
Yes. And the band, or the singer in this case, was Ryan Miller from Guster.
What a nice guy.
He was so nice.
He really was.
Funny and fun.
Super funny and very engaging, and he was very generous with his time. So we definitely want to thank Ryan and all their folks for helping us make that happen. We went down there on a Saturday afternoon and just sort of chilled while they were having something called a virtual sound check, which I've never really dealt with before, but, you know, it was the first time for everything, Jim.
So the cool thing about this interview was because Guster had two nights.
Yep.
A two-night engagement at the 9:30 Club.
That was cool.
I got to go to the show on Friday night. We did the interview on Saturday afternoon. So, you know, usually when we do these interviews, it's before the show. But in this case, I got to see the show first. So
that's cool.
So that was really fun. And, you know, they sold out two nights there, which people aren't familiar. That's about 1,200 capacity. Mm-hmm. So double that. And they had like two-night passes and stuff like that. And the other thing that they were doing this time was they weren't repeating any songs.
Yes.
So if people bought the two-night passes, you know, they would get a completely unique show each time.
And he said, I think that was the first time they'd ever done that.
I think he said they have enough songs
to
really make it work.
Yeah, that's cool.
One of the themes I think you're going to hear in this interview is that they like to change their sound, and they can be sometimes kind of hard to categorize.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my feeling listening to their stuff because, you know, usually when you know of these bands, you sort of have a sense of like where they fit in the music scene.
Mm-hmm.
But Guster is one of those, it's kind of perplexing. Like where are they exactly? You know, but yet they have this really passionate fan base. Yeah.
And you'll hear us touch on that in the interview when, you know, Ryan is talking about what are other bands that change their sound, you know, pretty much on a lot of their albums or constantly evolving. And, you know, that's, I think, a thread that goes through. And
right.
I think when we talked about why they do that and what the motivations are, that was really interesting to me.
All right, let's get to the interview. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And here is Ryan Miller of Guster. Ryan Miller, Guster, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for coming here.
Absolutely.
I went to the show last night.
Okay.
And so that leads me to this first question. What's it like being in a band for 27 years?
That was your takeaway of after seeing a show? Or like, man, these guys are old. No, how do you keep doing it?
It was because you said on stage that you were doing a lot of press, and that was the question you always get asked, right?
Well, no, I mean, I think there is... It's fun now, like this is the beginning of this process of releasing this record. So there's always like, this is the time when it's like, there's the intense navel gazing, sort of contemplative backward / forward looking state of the union kind of question stuff that happens. And usually it relates to the record you just put out, right? So if you put out a dud, it kind of changes the narrative maybe than if you didn't. And it seems like we didn't. Right now, the early feedback has been really good. And a narrative that I think has kind of been going on for the last, you know, 18 years was that we're sort of kind of changing our thing every time, and that seems to be on the tip of people's lips this time, maybe more than normal.
Yeah,
maybe than last record or two, which I really like because it feels like pretty significant departure in some ways texturally, and but not necessarily in the song. So I think to answer your question, to have done something that feels radical within the community that we've built and have it also be accepted after 27 years, those, all those feelings are tied in together in a very like humbled and proud way, because it was such a kind of crazy thing and it's all seems to be working really well. So it's cool to be in a band for 27 years if you can kind of be in a new band every 4 years, which is basically we did.
Yeah, that's pretty smart. Yeah. And what are those feedback channels that you were saying, you know, you got the early feedback? Where is it that you guys sort of pay attention to see if people are reacting in the way you might want?
Everybody in the band would answer that question differently. Mm-hmm. Mine was like early was just playing it for friends, like where you know they can't lie.
Right.
Or you could just feel a reaction. And so I kind of felt certain things were evident on that round. But also I'm just like an obsessive Googler. Okay. Like I run, basically Brian runs the Twitter. I run the, Brian runs the Instagram. I run the Twitter. And so I'm just like, I put Guster as a search term, like not even an at. So when people just mention it in passing, I just see what pretty much I have a good idea of where we fall into all this, more probably than is healthy, to be perfectly honest. But it's cool because, I mean, there's always a couple of people like, oh, what have they done? I wish they would sing in harmony and strum acoustic guitars and play bongos. But inevitably, the people that are still kind of with us and checking it out, are really stoked. So yeah, it's a lot of Twitter stuff, some Facebook, but obviously playing shows, you kind of get a reaction. Mm-hmm. And I've met, you know, and then we have some super fans that come to a lot of shows who have been very vocal about their appreciation for the record this time. So yeah, it's all of it. IRL, mm-hmm. digital, whatever there is, I'm kind of paying attention to.
Yeah, and now you've got a C-level podcast.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's when you
C
know.
C-plus? B-minus? Let's elevate, guys. Well, let's get to B-minus.
What do you think it is about your band that your audience gives you permission to change the way you guys do? Because that doesn't happen with a lot of bands.
It really doesn't, and I think it was very hard fought or hard won. I don't know, what's the expression there? One of those two where I think the big one was when we left the first, like the 1.0 version of Guster, which was strummy acoustic guitars. Brian's only playing the upright kit, and there's harmonies that are galore. And that kind of like, I feel like we really reached our peak potential with that, with Lost and Gone Forever, our album we made with Steve Lillywhite in 99. And after that, Brian, I think, was just ready to groove, and it was like, we were listening to Talking Heads, we were listening to REM, and he's like, I just want to play a backbeat, you know? And so I think the word groove didn't really enter our lexicon until 1999, which is 5 years after we started as a band. So when that happened, I think when Keep It Together came out right after Lost and Gone and Forever, that was the big one where it was like, it was, I state this just to be overstating, but it was a version of Dylan like plugging his guitar in, because of what a lot of people liked about our band were the sort of was his, he was a very visually interesting percussion player.
Yes,
like there's
right.
like, so we were all worried about that. Like we're going to lose this really. And sonically it was kind of, it wasn't a good sound necessarily, but it was a very interesting sound.
Yes.
And so this sonic footprint that we had was completely inextricably tied up with our identity. And then it was like, well, let's not do that anymore. So of course there was reaction. There was reaction internally. There was reaction externally. But we really wanted to kind of see if we could then make a career on just being like songwriters and performers and you know, orchestrators. And so I think after that, it was sort of like, okay, then we felt like we were kind of in it and we were starting from scratch at Keep It Together. I'd never played bass before. Brian never played kit before. So we were almost like a garage band at that point, starting from scratch. So that's when we kind of came in and we're like, oh, well, now we're kind of interested in these synth textures that I've always kind of grew up with, or we're interested in groove in a different way. So I think the question was, why do we feel like we have permission?
The audience is willing to take this journey with you.
That, and what's cool is this, it almost feels like that was sort of a big question up until the last record. And this is the first time, as I was saying before about like how every record changes the sort of the story of the band. This feels like now it's almost being written into the Guster Bible. Like Guster is going to mess things up a little bit every time. And hopefully you'll get on board, but generally they do a good job with it. And I feel like this kind of, this record is more. So like, I love that that's like just now kind of the thing. And yeah, you're right. Like I've had this discussion, you know, a dozen times in the last 7 days. And I'm trying to think of the bands who have done this, who have done a similar thing and not necessarily at our scale, which is minor, but thinking about Wilco from their AM and into their Nels days and with everything in between. And like, who are the bands that have a precedent for A, being a band for 25 plus years, and then who have kind of messed with their formula pretty radically over the course of it? Do you guys have any ideas?
Well, it's funny. Last night when I was watching, I had this sort of revelation. It's funny you've already referenced them. I was thinking of R.E.M.
Yeah.
Because when you were playing some stuff off the new record, I was sort of like, this is kind of like when R.E.M. did Drive. And think about how different Drive is from like when they were a jangle pop band. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's, I wondered, true. I was like, these guys, I bet they're REM fans.
And we were, you know, especially like the early records were really big for us, but also like Green and things like that. But also like Out of Time was kind of my record. It's weird. Like I came into REM early, but Out of Time was one of the first ones I really locked in with. And so, you know, hopefully we're not in the last stages of REM's career, because those records don't hold up quite as much as I would like
they
them
do
to.
Not.
But yeah, I think you're right. Like REM definitely changed their approach. I mean, from that and that. I mean, but these are really bold examples, right? It's tough to be a band and be like, yeah, we're like the Talking Heads or REM right. or Wilco, you know. Right. But within the context of the band, I don't think it's an I think it's a generous consideration.
So that actually leads a little bit into a question I had for you, Ryan. This latest album, Leo Abrahams produced, and then previously the late great Richard Swift, you made a record with him. How do you work with a producer? Do you choose the producer knowing you're going to make this challenge to yourself, as you've put it, or, you know, maybe go in a different direction? Or does some of that happen organically after you've kind of made that, you know, hook up with whoever's going to work with you on the record?
It's a really good question. I think that generally part of why our evolution, why the band changes from record to record, it has a lot to do with the producer. Yeah. So we both put somebody in our orbit, like Swift. We were fans of him for a long time. I knew about him from my buddy Eric Johnson from Fruit Bats. He had put Richard on our wavelength like years ago. It was like, I think you and Richard would make something really cool. Really? And so I never heard of him, but then I kind of kept an eye, and I was like, oh, this Minor Birds record is pretty cool. But then the Foxygen, the Damien Girard records were amazing. When the Foxygen record came, we were just like, oh my god! Like, and he played drums on that whole record, and it just sounded. And so all of a sudden you listen to all his entire catalog, and this aesthetic comes out, and it was like, and we had this whole thing with Eric and Swift about how he just like knew Swift really well, and he's like, and he was kind of like whispering, he was kind of the whisperer for that. So we kind of knew that when but we didn't know what we were going to get into, like, are we going to make a Guster Foxygen record? Like, we kind of were like, the idea in the situation like that, especially with a personality as strong as Swift, was we just had to give into the process. We're like, all right, this is how you want to do it. You don't want to pre-produce? You don't want to hear our songs before we get there? And wait, what do you mean? You're going to do first takes and you're going to use two mics on the drums, one on the kick and one for the rest of the kit? But then he starts doing it and it sounds good. And so you're like, all right, we're only here for 3.5 weeks. Let's just say yes to as much as we can. See where we come out. Yeah. And we came out, it was like, we just made a record, you know. He didn't mix it because there were certain things, like Swift had a blind spot about certain stuff because he didn't want to be too fussy or fastidious about things. So we took it to Phil Ack to mix, and we kind of like got the best of both worlds. Yeah. But then with this record, it was like two or three names on our producer list, and it had a lot to do with what we thought we wanted the record to sound like. So, I mean, which is funny because we also worked with John Congleton, who is a completely different aesthetic than Leo, and very similar to Swift. Their approaches are very similar, but, and it was sort of like, I think we were just open. That's why we like the idea of working with multiple producers. We're like, well, let's just try some stuff and see what works. And we started with Leo, and we locked in, like in Calgary when we started the record, it was like day four or something. And we were like, holy shit. This is good. Like, and this is good in a weird way. Like, we knew he had a whole bag of tricks, but we didn't know how his bag of tricks was going to interface with our writing. And it just like, it just did it. And we were so, it was crazy. It was like a very magical, I mean, I hadn't had an experience with a producer like that since like Lily White. And that was a completely different dynamic because we were babies and he was this massive guy. Yeah. And this just felt like, it almost felt like Leo was in our band, like the coolest dude ever that played in our band. So we didn't think that, I didn't have a vision for Look Alive sounding like this necessarily. I had probably dreams of it, but I didn't even know how to do that kind of stuff because of what he brought into it, his ability to manipulate sound like through Ableton. I just never seen that before, and the toys that we were able to get our hands on in the keyboard museum, and yeah, so it was really, he ended up being the sound of the record. We chose him, but we didn't know what that sound would be.
Right, I got
And we
you.
Also, like, we did three songs with Congleton, and only one made the record. Mm-hmm. And we love John, and the other song's great, but it, like, it didn't go in the way that it felt like it had to be this record, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's very, you know, I think at this point, one of the really good things about being a creative person after this long, especially with the same people, is you learn to trust the process a lot of times. And, like, you just go in and you're like, okay, let's just say yes and see what happens.
Yeah.
And so we really did. And we got really rewarded, I think, because Leo was just such a great collaborator for us.
It almost sounds like maturity in some ways, which is very
cool. I mean, there's a lot of life lessons that come into all this stuff. You know what I mean? About like not caring what people think, and that, like, that's the least valuable place you can put your energy. I mean, says the guy who like Googles himself 25 times a day. But you know what I mean? It's stuff that you know that you can apply to your band. And especially because I've been in the same band with these same dudes with two of them, you know, the whole time we're all on the same wavelength in a lot of ways, like very fundamental stuff.
So let me ask you about one of the songs on the new record, Hard Times, and related to what you're just talking about. So I was at home this afternoon playing the acoustic version, and my wife, who hadn't heard the song before, she's listening to it, and about halfway or three quarters through, she was like, this song is going to make me cry. So that was nice. You know, that was a real reaction.
Enter a scene that defies description. They say to open your mind, take it all inside, one click at a time. We move through fiction and send our sisters to the sacrifice. Cruel conviction. Sinister systems keep us satisfied. These are hard times.
I'm breathing in the oxygen. I'm holding it through hard times.
My question is, though, you released an acoustic version, but you also released the version that's on the record itself, which has, you know, vocal effects and it's all sort of
very
electronic
processed
and everything. So what was your thought behind that? Where did you think, like, that's what this song needs?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what it is, because we made that song and it was very, I feel like with the vocal processing, and that's a drum machine that's like, Brian's barely playing on that song. Like, we couldn't have been, that seems sonically to be as far away from like what our band was in a lot of ways, which was fine. I don't think we had a problem with that at all. And actually, it's going to sound very cynical, because our manager, I mean, as I'm sure you guys discussed, we are all subject to the great algorithm in the sky, or not even the sky, in Spotify.
Right.
And so, you know, for whatever reason, management and label were like, acoustic playlists, they have a lot of value. Would you be interested in, like, I think you guys need to record some acoustic versions of the songs just to get into the playlist. Mm. And I mean, we're sitting in Henry Jameson's dressing room right now, and he's got 80 million plays because his music is smart, literate, acoustic leaning, but also not so down the middle. Like, he just hits this perfect thing. And that's, he has literally 80 million plays. And so it's like watching that kind of stuff was like, and so we went and tried it, and we went to actually to Joe Pazapia's studio in Nashville to record a couple things. And it was really hard at first, but there was something also kind of cool. It was kind of a good exercise, because we like to really say, like, these are all great songs, and it doesn't matter if they're synthesizers or not. Ideally, if you just strip it back to a guitar and a vocal, or a piano and a voice, that these are great songs. Right. And so it felt like a cool assignment to be like, all right, is this Hard Times? This is actually good when you take the drum machine and all this vocoder out. And we started playing it. We're like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. And then I think that's why we've even played it live a few times. It's kind of like, it's not like a shut up to anybody, but it's just sort of like, underneath it, there's a really thoughtful lyric. These are cool changes. It sounds like it's like a song.
Okay. So you actually went the opposite way. You had sort of the produced version, and then you did the acoustic version. Okay. And I kind of figured the acoustic was more like a demo.
No,
and then
that song came together in the studio with all these sounds. The sounds, actually, the reason that we even did this, because we were at Soundcheck in Rochester, New York. We had a show in the middle of our studio run, and I got this vocal pedal because I was playing with it, and the guy started playing some music, and then I was just like, Brian goes, that was awesome. I was like, what was awesome? He's like, what we just did. I was like, I literally was just going through like presets on my vocal thing. And he's like, no, we recorded it. I'll send it to you. And he peeled out these two pieces. And then we went into the studio. We had never done this and wrote it in the studio. Like, there was a Linn drum machine sitting on the floor, and we plugged it into an amp, and it kind of cracked out. And then I was writing lyrics in the studio. I've never done that, like, where I didn't have anything. And it was sort of like, okay. So I think it was, again, it was like a cool thing to be like, all right, wait, is this actually really a good song, or is it just kind of sonically fun? And so to hear the reaction, you know, my wife loves that song. And she was like, especially when I was last year, it was like right in the middle of all the Me Too stuff. And she was like, you need to put this out tomorrow. This is our anthem. Right. And that kind of stuff, which I, you know, I'll take.
Sure.
That's definitely one of the things we're going for.
So along those lines, you said last night at the show that the record reflects our times today, but yet you also said you still have a lot of optimism just as an individual.
Yeah. I mean, I have optimism, I think, you know, like, yesterday I have a friend who was elected to Congress, Dean Phillips from Minnesota. And I went to his office yesterday to be like, all right, what's going on? how was this going? And like,
yesterday was an interesting political day.
I was watching the government reopen, sitting next to a congressman, and their reaction was exactly like mine. I was like, oh right, you guys are like feeling this the same way. You're totally human. And he told me some like behind the scenes stuff that felt very like made a lot of sense. And I've said this quote a few times, but you know, it's like the arc of history bends towards the just. And I feel like in my lifetime, in our lifetime, I've seen, you know, the discussion of racism, homophobia, misogyny, you know, global environmental things. It just feels generationally like things are starting to get better. You look at even the lack of religiosity, all these things, you just look and you're like, okay, we're on some kind of trajectory, and the old white dudes are all going to die. And there's going to be a new multicultural thing. Yeah. And there'll still be remnants of all this stuff. And the global warming thing might kill us before we actually figure it out. But I generally have felt like that arc being a real thing. And so in the midst of all this, it really threw me for a loop of like, I don't feel like bad behavior gets rewarded at this level very often. And I've talked to a lot of people about it. And I'm like, you know, I ask people, I'm like, how do you retain your optimism? It's like a big question I ask other people when I talk to them. And, you know, even talking to Dean yesterday, he's like, you know, we all want the same things. And to hear this from like somebody that's really in there, and it's cool to think about this stuff and how like in a way, really, it seems horrible, and it is horrible, but it also isn't going to be this way forever. I really don't think so. And that's kind of what the record is about. There's a lot of that in the record of like, that's why we call the album Look Alive. It's like a call to arms in a way. Like, it's just something I would say to my kids, like in the morning, they're getting ready. It's like, all right, guys, look alive. We got to do this.
Yeah.
You know?
Stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up. Walking in my sleep, never to awaken. Be loved, be loved, be loved, be loved. Look alive. Dancing in the dark before hallucinations. Be loved, be loved, be loved.
Okay, so that was part one of the interview. We're actually going to do this over three episodes. So
spread it out.
You'll want to tune in tomorrow to hear more from Ryan. There's some good stuff. We talk about one of their more interesting songs on the new record tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, and one other thing I want to say about Guster as performers.
Uh-huh.
The other thing I found really interesting about going to their show was, for the most part, they can all play like multiple instruments.
Yeah.
So they were performing as a five-piece here. I think they had an extra guy for the tour. But it's every song is, you know, them switching around. So, you know, one guy will be on the keyboards, another guy will be on the bass, another guy will be on guitar, and then it moves, you know, differently. And, you know, we know the drummer in the band, the band started off with him playing like bongos and stuff like that, and eventually moved into a real drum kit. So he still does some of each of that, depending on the song. And I watch it, and I think to myself, how do they even keep track of all this?
I know. It's amazing. And they're going to do completely new songs in the next night?
Right.
That's crazy. You know, backstage at the 930 Club, at least in the part where we were, or actually both parts are kind of above where the stage is when you walk out in the little areas on some of the backstage dressing rooms. And you look down, and there was like seven keyboards on that stage.
Oh, yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah. So, obviously, this new album, very keyboard heavy, so that's a new addition to their sound for the most part. You know, and here's another thing, Patrick, you know this from being in bands. They can play like trumpet and trombone and stuff like that. And that's unusual. Like a guy who can play guitar can learn how to play the bass.
Right.
You know, guitar and keyboard even, that's not uncommon, right?
Right.
But for somebody to be able to play the trumpet.
That's crazy. It really is.
It just
is.
Feels like a totally different thing, right?
yeah, exactly.
And play it well. So that was something.
Yeah. And you know, it definitely sounds like they've got some samples and electronic stuff that they trigger as well. So it's pretty neat.
It was cool. It was really fun. All right, let's move on to tomorrow.
Okay.
We'll hear more from Ryan then. And you're going to listen to tomorrow because, of course, you're listening.
Every day. Every single day. That's what you do.
Right. I think Ryan was quite taken with the idea that we do this 5 days a week. The show is on all the big podcast platforms. Please rate and review on iTunes. Mm-hmm. Please subscribe. Please subscribe other people. Please also, if you like Guster or want to comment on that, you can email us rock@suburbspod.com or call and leave a message
612-440-1984.
Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at Suburbs Pod.
Do that.
Visit our website, suburbspod.com, all that stuff. Do all that, those things.
All the things.
All right, let's get out of here. Move on to part two of the interview.
Cool, cool.
It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
Oxygen, I'm holding it through hard times. I'm breathing out in the ultrasound. Things come around.
Is this recording? I give you a perpetuity to use these background music.
All right, thank you for that.
Officially said.
For all Guster songs, yeah.